This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Falling oil prices have hit oil companies and their workers pretty hard, but that's nothing compared to what's happened to the Venezuelan economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I am Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, March 23rd, 2016. I'm glad you could join us. We'll start today with housing. We're headed into spring and summer when lots more houses come on the market. There's news today that it's been a decent, if not amazing, winter for housing. And there is slow and steady growth in new home construction and sales. But there are also a lot of reasons why these numbers should be a lot better. Rents are up, mortgages are cheap, and more people have jobs to pay those mortgages. So what's going on? From the Marketplace desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
It seems like you hear home construction everywhere in my hot urban neighborhood of Portland, but head out to the suburbs of many American cities, and it's a lot quieter. The subdivisions of modest single-family homes with a little yard and a two-car garage aren't being built like they used to in the boom years of the 90s and 2000s. Jessica Louts at the National Association of Realtors says the shortage of homes for sale in urban and suburban markets is sending prices higher.
Pushing first-time home buyers and millennials and single home buyers who traditionally would be a force in the market to the sidelines because they aren't able to afford a home right now.
That imbalance of supply and demand should lead builders to put up more starter homes where land is cheaper out in the burbs. And it will in time, says economist Robert Dietz at the National Association of Home Builders.
All the supply-side headwinds are follow-on effects from the Great Recession. There was concern by the banks. Is this a market that we want to take risk making those loans? But generally, we do see things improving.
But one key component of full recovery from the recession hasn't shown up, and that's young people starting families. Their careers were delayed, they have debt and economic anxiety. University of New Hampshire demographer Kenneth Johnson.
Young Americans are still not having babies. Anything that delays children is likely to have an impact on housing.
Johnson says if those 20 and 30-somethings don't start having babies, even as the economy improves, there could be less demand for new homes for a generation to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Department of Labor today announced a new rule designed to pull back the curtain on companies that are trying to stop union efforts. Right now, when a company hires a consultant to help fight a union organizing drive, and let's be clear, most of them do, they only have to disclose that information if the consultant directly contacts employees. The new rule, which takes effect next month, makes companies disclose any discussions to combat union activity. Gigi Duban has more.
These consultants are called persuaders. And as soon as a company gets wind that a union is trying to organize, they're the ones management calls. Nelson Lichtenstein directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
There's a whole industry of law firms and consultants whose job it is to fight unionization.
An estimated 75% of companies pay these consultants hundreds of thousands of dollars, basically to tell management what to say to discourage workers from unionizing. Things like,
the union can't force us to do anything. It's just typical stuff that union's bad, employer's good, we don't need a third party.
That's Maria Soma, director of organizing for United Steelworkers. She says for years, unions have had to disclose info on staff salaries and union dues. But companies have not had to disclose how much they're spending fighting unions.
I just think it's just making it a little bit more fair.
The decline of unions over the last few decades has contributed to stagnant incomes for the middle class. At the same time, the anti-union consulting business has prospered.
This industry has grown from a very small industry in the 1970s to a multi-billion dollar international industry.
That's Stephanie Luce. She teaches labor studies at the City University of New York's Murphy Institute. She says requiring transparency is just one small step the Obama administration is taking to level the playing field. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, the dollar is up, but stocks are down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here are some things that have been happening in the beverage industry. Soda sales have been declining over about a decade. And as it turns out, good old-fashioned milk and cereal, also not so popular anymore. Milk sales have been dropping since at least 2009. But you know what consumers have been doing? Paying a little extra for healthy foods, and bonus if those foods are all about the protein. So what better opportunity for Coca-Cola and a high-end dairy cooperative to team up and build a better milk? And they're not the only ones. Shruti Singh is a reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek, and she wrote about the move toward designer milk. Hi, Shruti. How are you?
Great. Great to be here.
So tell me about the forces that have brought Coca-Cola and milk together.
Well, a couple of things are happening. One is that Americans are drinking less sugary, fizzy water. And the other thing that's happening is that they're really interested in natural products with clean labels. So Coca-Cola, a couple of years, joined forces with a dairy cooperative to create a company called Fairlife, which is now producing over the last year a filtered high-protein, low-sugar, lactose-free milk. It's a mouthful, but there's a lot going on in there.
And why does the dairy cooperative want to work with Coke? Is milk also in trouble?
Well, milk consumption over the last 30, 40 years per capita has been declining as we've been drinking other beverages, whether it be juices or more water or Gatorade or whatever you want to call it. So we've all just been drinking a little bit less milk every single year. And milk is really interested as an industry, and this particular co-op is particularly interested in getting into the branded milk business.
And as you say, it's not ordinary milk. Is all of the milk that they're producing this? Is it fair to call it designer milk?
Well, that's sort of the term we've used. But basically, this is a brainchild of a veterinarian turned farmer named Mike McCluskey, and he produced this filtration system that you can separate out the protein and the sugars and the lactose from milk and really create a milk that serves different consumer needs.
Have you tried any of it?
I have. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, so how much does this stuff cost?
It costs about $4 for a 52-ounce bottle and double what the conventional stuff costs.
Wow. How is the how's the sales strategy working so far?
Well, in the first year on the shelves, Fairlife has reached about $90 million in sales. And Coke's intent is on making milk a billion-dollar brand.
Does that seem likely? Are specialty milk sales doing well?
Yeah, so Fairlife has actually been able to boost specialty milk sales quite a bit in 2015 to a growth rate of about 21%, up from something like 9% a year earlier.
That's Shruti Singh, a reporter for Bloomberg News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Oil prices have clawed back to around $40 a barrel, but that's still down by two-thirds compared to less than 2 years ago. And while that's good news for drivers, it has shattered lives in petrostates around the world. None are worse off than Venezuela. We'll give you a couple numbers. Worst inflation in the world for 3 years running, somewhere between 180 and 400%. GDP shrank 10% last year. And a year ago on the street, one U.S. dollar bought 200 Venezuelan bolivars. Today, it's 1,000. But what about real life there? Marketplace's Scott Tong has just returned from Venezuela and has this report.
Imagine your grocery bill goes up by 17-fold. A loaf of bread, $32. A dozen eggs, $18. Pound of coffee, $85. We are in Venezuela. First, though, let's get in line, something everybody seems to do here. Single mom Noslyn Ramos is queued up outside a state supermarket.
The situation is critical. We need flour and rice and coffee. Right now we have no food for lunch.
This is Maracaibo, Venezuela's original oil city. Now, though, crude prices have crashed, and so has normal life. 20 people are lined up in front of the store, but the other 200 have been shooed around to the back alley, where we are, ostensibly to hide this crisis.
It's common to sleep in line. If we come at 5 in the morning, there is already a big line. The people in the front, they probably slept here.
There's no guarantee anything will be left on the shelves when she gets there. Ramos sells empanadas for a living, makes minimum wage. So does her sister, Michelle Suarez, standing next to her, who explains the rationing system here. You can only buy 2 of anything in a week.
Hasta la próxima semana.
The problem is, our family has 12 people, so 2 bags of rice lasts just one day. So we go to other supermarkets and shop all day. Some stores don't take cash, but I don't have a debit card, and the bank says there's not enough plastic to make more.
If they don't find rice here, they'll buy a bag at a place where they know it's available, on the black market. But it's steep. A 1.6-pound bag costs 2 days of pay. A big can of milk costs 1 week's salary. Venezuelan pollster and analyst Luis Vicente León has never seen it so bad.
Absolutely the worst ever. It's amazing. It's very difficult to find any country in the world that the people cannot find essentials.
He has an index of scarcity of goods missing from the store shelves, and right now it exceeds 70%. Why? Well, it amounts to economic multiple organ failure. First, Venezuela hardly makes anything. Price controls destroy the profit motive for domestic companies, and the socialist government has taken or expropriated entire companies.
They expropriate the majority of the sugar companies, and you cannot find sugar. They expropriate coffee companies in Venezuela, and you cannot find coffee. They expropriate Owens, Illinois, and we cannot find packages.
So Venezuela imports just about everything. But now there's not enough oil revenue to buy the imports. He says it's like having 2 diseases, dengue fever and then Zika virus on top of it.
We are mixing 2 different illnesses right now. The illness coming from the intervention and the impact of the oil market.
The shortages drive anyone who can afford it to the black market. Now, mostly it's underground. Buyers find sellers through friends or through closed chat groups on Facebook. It is illegal. But in Maracaibo, the black market is an actual place. The contrabando, as they call it, it sits out in the open. Now, the odd part is this stuff is basically what's available on aisle 3 in the Safeway back home. There's flour, rice, coffee, Tylenol. We try to pick up infant formula for our driver's baby, but by the time we find it, it's sold. Even my translator, Yesmen Utrera, starts to shop here for coffee. He says you gotta get it wherever you can. Back in the car, he goes over a few of the prices, including the most important staple, corn flour.
The regulated price, you can see it on the package, is 19 bolivars. And the price in this market is 600 bolivars. A bag of diaper can cost 300 bolivars. And in here, they can sell it into 1,200, 4 times its price.
The rice costs 20 times normal, baby Tylenol 60x. The average markup, by our math, is 17 times here. This woman selling plantains at the market says she can't find milk for her grandchildren, and she can't pay the scalper price. So she makes her own substitute out of plantains.
I open up the fruit and take the seed out, otherwise it hurts their tummy. I cook it and blend it, then I cook it again for 5 minutes. Stir and add a little sugar. It's the economy, you know.
Back in the grocery store line, the two sisters aren't just hungry and frustrated about all this. They're furious. They may not understand how Venezuela has become an oil-only economy, but they do see profiteers making money off this crisis. Noslyn Ramos figures some of the food that's missing from store shelves slips out the back door.
Donde diariamente yo veo los camiones.
Every day when I walk to work, I see trucks loaded with flour, sugar, rice, shampoo, milk, driving to Colombia to resell them. I want to take a picture, but I'm scared what might happen to me.
Como dicen, por miedo.
The man behind her interrupts to say, wait a second, we're a rich country. Indeed, in the 1970s oil boom, there was single malt scotch all across Venezuela. There were trips to Miami. The Concorde flew here. Ramos says somebody's getting richer, but it isn't her. And then she cites a Bible scripture about a famine prophecy coming true. And it will likely get worse here, unless oil prices miraculously skyrocket. By one estimate, the available petrodollars to buy food and medicine will shrink this year by two-thirds. In Maracaibo, Western Venezuela, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the ancient gods of Greece, Rome, Egypt all still exist. Except today, they wear spandex and capes.
Batman is the new Zeus. Discuss. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 79 points, 0.4%, to finish at 17,502. The Nasdaq lost 52 points, 0.1%, to close at 4,768. The S&P 500 was off 13 points, 0.6%, to end the day at 2036. Virgin America flew up 13.2% on reports it was considering selling itself or part of the company to potential buyers. Falling oil prices dragged energy stocks lower. Chesapeake Energy gave up 14.3%. Marathon Oil skidded 9.9%. Chevron slid 2%. Fast food chain Yum Brands plumped up 1.9%. The Wall Street Journal reported the company was talking with KKR about possibly selling a stake in its China business. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
I grew up a punk, and I think that's what you see.
The only car companies in the U.S. that have not gone bankrupt are currently Ford and Tesla.
You know, the whole conversation about celebrity has completely changed.
The best part of this job is the people I get to talk to, people running the most influential companies in the world. Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, Elon Musk, who runs Tesla, and Janice Min from The Hollywood Reporter. Hear my conversations with all of those people and many, many more on the Corner Office podcast.
Want to get social with Marketplace? Connect with our hosts, reporters, and producers online. Tell us what you think about our stories or suggest your own. Follow us on Twitter at Marketplace and like Marketplace APM on Facebook or Instagram.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Lots of people took to Twitter today with the hashtag #WeAreHereForYou, Justin, as in Justin Bieber. The pop star has canceled his expensive post-concert meet and greets with fans. They're part of a VIP ticket package that can run as high as $2,000. But Bieber says the meet and greets with his Beliebers, are we still calling them that? Anyway, the meet and greets, they were wearing him out. He's got a lot of cities left on his tour, so he's potentially leaving big money on the table. That's interesting because concert tours, of course, are the main source of income for musicians these days. And these add-ons, like meet and greets, are all part of the business strategy. Nova Sappho has more.
Ralph Jakadine has been to a Justin Bieber meet and greet for his teenage daughter, of course.
It seemed like maybe 1,000 people or so. It was a line that took hours.
Jakadine just happens to be an artist manager, and he says the most important element of Bieber's meet and greet was that you had to go online afterwards to retrieve your photo with him.
Because then somebody aggregates a lot of email names.
Ah, and that's the key, he says, because email lists are gold. Jakadine employs them with his own artists. They're not huge pop stars, so they use email for crowdfunding.
One of my artists has 15,000 people on his email list. Our last two campaigns, we've raised over $100,000.
That kind of direct contact is essential to building an artist's brand, says Fabrice Sergent. He heads the concert discovery app Bands in Town.
Artists had to create and strengthen their relationship with their fans.
It doesn't hurt that meet and greets and other sideshows at concerts are lucrative. Jeff Dornfeld teaches music business and management at the Berklee College of Music in Boston.
It's very common to do this for both the artist and the promoter to depend on ancillaries as a major revenue stream.
Dornfeld says artists have gone beyond merchandising like T-shirts, hats, and CDs. They're now doing things like
the soundcheck ticket, go backstage and you meet someone in the band or whatever. There's all kinds of packages that go with a concert.
Dornfeld says it can all add up to a nice little bump on top of that big main source of revenue, the concert itself. In Chicago, I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
Two of the biggest franchises in superhero history collide in theaters this weekend, Batman versus Superman. To the delight of geeks like me, it is almost impossible in recent years to imagine a time when the box office wasn't dominated by Caped Crusaders and Men of Steel. But believe it or not, there is one guy who, in large part, is responsible for comic book movies as we know them. His name is Michael Uslan. And when you're watching Batman versus Superman this weekend, look for his name in the credits as an executive producer. Uslan's name is, in fact, on every Batman film because he owns the character. And the way he got him is kind of a crazy story. Here's Michael Uslan telling it himself.
It was a cold night in January 1966. I had been waiting for months for this night. I was 14 years old. The Batman TV show was about to debut on ABC.
This is an ABC color presentation.
And then it came on the air, and I was horrified by what I was seeing.
Good heavens.
The entire world was laughing at Batman, and that just killed me. That night, downstairs in my den, I made a vow, not unlike Bruce Wayne, that somehow, someday, I would find a way to show the world what the true Batman is and erase from the collective consciousness of the world culture these three little words that were soon to haunt me for decades: pow, zap, and wham. And that became my mission. So I went to Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana. It was the early 70s, a time of great experimentation on college campuses. I think that's all I'll say about that. In response to the times, the College of Arts and Sciences began an experimental curriculum department. So I designed a course on comic books. I began my pitch. The dean had this little pair of half glasses perched at the edge of his nose, and he looks over them down at me, and he let me speak for 2 minutes and then cut me off. He said, "Mr. Uslan, all comic books are cheap entertainment for little children. Give me a break here." And in what would become a life-changing moment for me, I said, "Are you familiar with the story of Moses?" He said, "Yeah, so? By any chance, do you recall the origin of Superman? Comic books and superheroes are our modern-day mythology. The ancient gods of Greece, Rome, Egypt all still exist. Except today, they wear spandex and capes." And then he stops, stares at me for what I swear to you was an eternity, and then says, "Your course is accredited." I am now the world's first college professor of comic books. I got back to my apartment, and I picked up the phone and I called United Press International. I asked to speak to a reporter, and I started to scream at him. "What is wrong with you? You're supposed to be the watchdog of our society." And he says, "Calm down. What are you talking about?" And I go, "Are you kidding me? I hear there's a course on comic books being taught at Indiana University. I'm a taxpayer in this state. They are using my money to teach our kids comic books? This has got to be some communist plot to subvert the youth of America." And I slammed down the phone. And my telephone started to ring, and it never stopped. The NBC Nightly News, the CBS Evening News, virtually every newspaper in North America. I never taught one class that wasn't filled with reporters. About 2 weeks or so later, my phone rings. It's a vice president from DC Comics in New York. Next thing I know, they offer me a job. I'm still at IU, and I am writing Batman comics. At that point in time, going into the 70s, the president of DC Comics, a wonderful man named Saul Harrison, I said, "Since Batman went off the air on television, nobody's interested in Batman anymore." And that's when I remembered back to that cold night in January 66 and the vow that I made. And I said, "Saul, I want to buy the rights to Batman and make these dark and serious movies."
He was chagrined and said, "Michael, for God's sake, don't do this. I don't want to see you lose all your money. Is there any way I can talk you out of this?" And I said, "No." And he shrugged and he said, "All right, Schmoozle, come on in." So when people say, "We don't understand, how does a kid in his 20s buy the rights to Batman?" it's a very unglamorous answer. I got him because nobody else on the planet Earth wanted him.
Michael Uslan spent 10 years pitching the idea of his Dark Batman movie to every studio in Hollywood, and he finally had some luck when he teamed up with a young director named Tim Burton. So far, Batman movies have raked in a cool $4.5 billion, and comics have been movie gold ever since. And this final note before we go, there may be a little bit of trouble brewing in the on-demand economy. That's the term for the dozens of apps and services that have sprung up to take care of you, grocery shop for you, bring you takeout from local restaurants or 7-Eleven, park your car and then bring it to you at the end of the day, maybe gas up your car while it's parked, basically deliver anything to you anytime, anywhere. CB Insights reports that financing for these on-demand companies has dropped off dramatically in recent months. Instacart, the startup that will shop for you and then deliver the groceries, has announced changes in the way it pays its shoppers, and some of them will make less money. It also said it's going to fire all of its drivers and basically close up shop in the city of Minneapolis. This is a big development in the tech world, since investors poured almost $18 billion into funding companies like these ones, despite the fact that even Amazon is struggling with how to make delivery cost-effective. It turns out there is a price for convenience. It just looks like that price might be jobs, startups, and investor returns. And I will have to do my own grocery shopping. Womp womp. All right, that's it, everyone. That's our show. Today, the Dow fell 79 points, or 0.4%. The NASDAQ lost 52 points, 1.1%. And the S&P 500 was off 13 points, 0.6%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer this program for us. I am Molly Wood. Thanks for listening. See you again tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.